I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And we're back on the Functional Nerds. John, I don't know if you realize this, but we're creeping up on 400 episodes.
What? That's legitimately shocking to me. I really thought you were going to say 200.
Nope. I believe we just dropped like 375, 376. So,
well, let me ask you this. Do you know the actual, off the top of your head, the actual year that we started?
It would have been 2008 or 9.
Okay. So yeah, so it's been
when I moved into this house. So probably it was 2009 because I moved into this house in 2008 in December. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like we got started sometime in 2009.
Well, yeah, so we're coming up on 10 years then probably.
Mm-hmm.
Which that's weird. 10 years is a weird thing, isn't it? Because that's a big chunk of life right there, and we've been doing this for that long. It's something. It's a part of our lives in a way. And I know we were talking about it last week with just the two of us with the social media thing, but we were in a different place when we started it than we are now. Although you're still writing and you're still doing your thing, but I think you approach things a lot differently than you did 10 years ago. But yeah, I think we looked at this podcast as a way to promote our things. And then I think we realized you much sooner than I did that, oh, the podcast is better if you just let it be what it is and don't try to promote your stuff all the time, you know? And, it took me a while to get there, but I think I enjoy doing the podcast way more since I don't have an agenda going into it. I just look at the podcast as being the podcast, and it's something that you and I do, and it's a nice part of our life. And yeah, so 10 years on that. So there you go.
I feel like I should reply with some sort of television melodrama dynasty kind of monologue about, you know, how no one thought we would last and we're still together.
I alluded to this point in the last Just the Two of Us, but I had the idea of us doing a podcast for months before I brought it up to you because I was really busy at the time. And I just thought, like, do I really want to throw something else on my plate? Like, I really don't know if I want to commit to something like that, but it just wouldn't leave my mind. There was some part of me that thought, I think doing that will work. For some reason, with the our skill sets and our, at the time, what was very important, as we were talking about with the social media thing, like I knew some people in the field and I felt like, well, then, you know, we can leverage some of those contacts to, you know, get some guests or get something, and Patrick's got his contacts and his skills and I have whatever I can bring. And I just really felt like it would work. And you know what? 10 years later, I guess it works because we're still doing it. I think the key to any of these kinds of things are knowing what your role is in it. And you and I have our jobs that we both do, and we're able to do it. I think when you're doing these kinds of things by yourself, it's really hard to sustain it. Because once you have a setback in life or just are super busy or in a family emergency, it's so easy to put something like this on the back burner. And I think you and I always had each other to sort of power through if we were having family issues or confidence issues or whatever the case may be. I'm sure we've brought it up on the podcast before, but I know there's been many times over the years, not recently though, but over the years where you and I would have sort of a state of the podcast conversation and, you know, one of us would get the feeling of, maybe we don't want to do this anymore, or should we do this anymore? Or, I don't know if I have time for this anymore. And fortunately, you and I were never felt that way at the same time. If you felt that way, I was super positive about it. And if I felt that way, you were super positive about it. So we kind of carried each other too. It's a good thing that, yeah, like that both of us weren't down at the same time, because it would have been like, yeah, let's stop. This is stupid. Why are we even bothered doing this?
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, so here we are. I do want to take a moment. You were talking about it before, but before we started recording, I want to thank our listeners who are enjoying these Just the Two of Us specifically. I'm always surprised and delighted to get such positive feedback on social media about these things. And I want to give a particular shout out to Matthew Kressel, who's a very accomplished author and does lots of cool things in the community. And he's really been ringing the bell for us lately. And I am appreciative of it. And I know you are too, Patrick. So thank you, Matt, and everyone else who gives us such nice feedback about the show.
Well, and what we were talking about is, and I agree with you completely, and thanks to everybody who's been doing that for us. These episodes where you and I just talk seem to be getting a lot of really good, you know, positive responses online. And that just validates what you and I kind of talk about off air. And how, you know, when we have a guest on, we have a specific thing we want to talk about. It's not always what we actually end up talking about,
right?
But you know, that's really all about promoting that author, their books, and kind of helping to boost their signal, right?
Sure.
We kind of wrap it into a different kind of conversation. A lot of times we talk about things other than their book, simply because those authors, they're so tired of having to give the same answers to the same questions and the same spiel over and over and over and over and over again, you know, as they're going through the promotional kind of grindhouse. And so we wrap it up in a different kind of conversation, but then you and I have these chats where there's trust me, folks, there's no agenda. We sit down and we go, okay, now we got to do another episode. What do we want to talk about? And Sean goes, we'll figure it out. And I go, okay. And we hit record.
Yeah, the first few minutes might be hard to get through before we land on what we want to talk about. But yeah, and with the guests even, just to give you a little peek behind the curtain, listeners, we have a bit of a format. It's not as tight as some shows, but it's not as loose as other podcasts that you may listen to either. There's a form and there's a main topic that we will talk about. And usually, especially if it's an author that we don't know that well, if it's a new person to the show, obviously we have authors that we've had on 3, 4, 5 times over the years and consider ourselves pretty friendly with them. And with them, it's, well, that's easy because now we have such a relationship with some folks that it's like, like we're going to have our next guest is someone that we've had on the show and have had a relationship for a long time. And I won't announce them just in case something falls through with that. But I don't have a main topic plan because I know, we go way back. There'll be plenty to talk about. It doesn't matter. You know, it'll be fun and it'll be interesting. But for some of the people that are new to us, I will usually put it to them. What do you feel like talking about? What are you into? Because as we've learned over the years, those are the most interesting conversations when we have a guest is, what is that guest into? Because if they can talk about something that's meaningful to them and interesting to them, then they can just keep talking. And with our most recent guest, Anna Smith Spark, I thought that was a great conversation and topic to talk about. And I really got a lot out of her perspective on things. And I hope our listeners do too, because that's sometimes we do go for more serious topics like that. Sometimes we go lighter, but I like that serious stuff too, if it's appropriate and in context. Then I really got a lot out of that one. So I hope listeners did too.
Yeah.
Patrick, so you posted something interesting on Facebook the other day about Apple taking away people's movies. Evil Apple. Evil Apple. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that story, because I always think that's kind of you bring it up a lot with the ebooks and with the audiobooks. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. Well, it started with there was a couple of people posting on Twitter about their experiences, and then that kind of blew up a little bit. And before you know it, there's actual media sites writing articles about it. But essentially, a Canadian Apple iTunes user found that a couple of movies that they had purchased had been removed from their account. And they started up a customer service email back and forth with Apple, you know, trying to find, or iTunes, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. And iTunes basically said, well, you know, the rights holder for that movie has pulled that movie from our service, so we can't offer it to you anymore. We no longer have the licensing. And the person said, well, I should get a refund then if you're taking the movie away from me. And iTunes like, well, you don't actually qualify for a refund, because refunds are, you know, there's a timetable involved, and if you've had the licensing for that movie for X amount of time, you no longer qualify for a refund. What we'll do is we'll give you a free rental credit.
Okay.
And the next time you rent a movie, it'll just be automatic. You'll get that rental for free. And, you know, this sparked the user to kind of go online and complain about this and do screenshots. And it blew up until news media sites started writing about it. And I think the article I may have shared may have been from Forbes.
Okay.
And it was talking, it may have been from somewhere else, but I looked at a lot of different articles on it. And it was talking about how, so the spin on the original postings was how evil Apple is, and Apple is screwing people over. And then this post brought Amazon in and Prime and was talking about, you know, just so you understand, this is not an Apple-centric thing. This is not an iTunes-centric thing. This is all digital platforms. And it always comes back to, people don't understand when they buy something digitally, they don't own it.
Right. I think...
And that's what we've talked about before.
Yeah, I think the actual wording is essentially that you're buying a license.
You are,
to use it. But
yes, and there's different language in the fine print of that licensing for different things.
Right.
And so what happened was Apple, their iTunes platform, they had received licensing rights for whatever this movie was. And so they were selling the movies and they were renting the movies. And then the distributor, the content creator, whoever owns that content, the contract expired. The rights no longer sit with iTunes to distribute that film or those films, because there was a couple. And so the licensing ends, so does your access to that movie through that platform.
Right.
So it goes away.
Yeah.
The same thing happened to me and to Fred Kish, with audiobooks. So I have bought all of the audiobooks for the James S.A. Corey Expanse series. And Fred was the first one who alerted me to the fact that suddenly Audible was no longer letting him listen to Leviathan Wakes, the first book. Well, something happened, and I'm not sure what. It could be that the rights to the books themselves reverted back to James S.A. Corey, to Daniel and Ty. And so they republished the audiobook. And when they republished the audiobook, it got a new ISBN, it got a new ASIN, which is the Amazon number, and the old one was discontinued. The licensing for that is gone now. So you can't listen to that audiobook on the Audible platform anymore that you purchased. You have to buy the new version of Leviathan Wakes if you want to listen to that audiobook. Again, it's all about the licensing on it, right? It's the same exact thing with Prime. Prime gets the licensing rights to a movie, and they have it up there, they're selling it, and if they lose the rights to that movie, you, who have quote-unquote bought the movie, also lose the rights to it, and it goes away. And it'll no longer be in your video queue.
I've noticed this kind of thing with the audiobook / ebook. So I have a bunch of ebooks that I've purchased that I haven't gotten to yet, that some of them I've had for years now, that there would be an associated audiobook, and then that sort of goes away. So I think it's sort of a similar situation. I think with one of the Brent Week books, Brent Week's books, say that, that's hard. The Black Prism, I think, is one of the first book mm-hmm. in one of his series. I bought that. Yep. Still haven't read that yet. And I think there was an associated audiobook with it. Now that's not available because I don't know if there was an edit or a rights change or something where the version of the ebook that I have does not match what the audiobook is at this point. So who knows what's going on there in terms of, and I've noticed that has happened sometimes with some of the books that I've had now for 5 years, 6 years that I haven't read yet, that kind of thing happens.
Yeah.
On a related, well, and oh, I'm sorry, keep going.
I was going to say there's another thing with ebooks, especially. Not all ebooks, but some ebooks have language within the fine print that limits how many times the book can be downloaded.
Mm.
So if you are like me and you have an old school Kindle and you download a book to that and then you upgrade, say to a Paperwhite or to a tablet or something like that, your books may not all be available to put on that new device until you buy them again.
That's interesting.
It depends. Yeah. It depends on the publisher. It depends on the rights. It depends on a lot of different things. It's not really clear when you buy the ebook how many downloads you get. This happened to, I want to say, Fred.
Right.
So Fred was a very early adopter of ebooks. He was on a completely different platform. He bought a ton of ebooks, had them all on the platform. The platform went under, whatever the ebook reader was at the time. The platform, the whole service went under. So therefore, all the rights were gone. Therefore, all the books were pulled off his device.
Wow.
And he lost them all.
Wow.
Then I want to say he got a Kindle very early on. And when he went to upgrade, he was deleting books from the old Kindle to download them onto the new Kindle. And that's when he discovered, and I could be completely misremembering, it could have been somebody else, but he discovered that he didn't have additional downloads on some of those ebooks. Sometimes it's really expensive, like technical books or textbooks for schools.
Right.
You know, for college, that kind of stuff, only have one download.
Right, because
associated with them.
Because otherwise, one person would buy it and give it to 30 people in their class or what have you. I think that's
potential.
I think that's the fear on the publishers.
Right. So there's a limited number of downloads, but really it all comes back down to licensing.
Right.
You don't own the digital copy of whatever it is you bought. You didn't really buy it. Even though you clicked buy now and maybe you paid $20 for it instead of the $3.99 to rent it or whatever it was, you didn't actually buy it.
Right.
And that's what's confusing a lot of people. They're used to, I buy something, I own it, it's mine. That's not really how it works in the digital sphere.
I think it's a little better nowadays than it used to be. I feel like you haven't heard this discussion as maybe you did 7-8 years ago when piracy was more of an issue. I know piracy still exists, obviously. But I think the way that digital platforms work these days with streaming and with audiobooks and ebooks and all of that that we're talking about now, I think it's a little bit of a different world where they're a little better about it. But it's still kind of maddening that a lot of these policies that they have in place in terms of number of downloads and all of that. And again, this is an argument that I heard a lot years ago. You're punishing the people who are actually paying for the stuff. You're punishing,
right, doing it legally.
Yeah, you're punishing the good customers because the people that are going to pirate it are just going to pirate it and they don't have to deal with any of this. And in some ways, you can argue that you're pushing people towards piracy by doing this, by making it harder to do things legally. You push people into piracy. I feel like you haven't heard this argument as much. I feel like it was more of an issue a few years ago, but it seems like the best way to keep customers is to make things easier, to make things good, because, you know, I think we're at a point now, which is why you don't hear this argument as much, where what you pay, whether it's paying for Netflix or it's paying for your ebook or it's paying for an Audible subscription, you pay whatever your fee is per month or your fee is per item, and everyone seems to be pretty satisfied with that arrangement. I know I am. I don't run into this kind of thing very often, but it seems foolish when you do run into it. It's like, look, you just want people, you are a marketing guy, you want people in your ecosystem. You want people in the habit of buying stuff. Like, make them happy, because every time something happens where it makes their experience difficult or negative, then you're going to encourage them to go someplace else. And I don't think that's what you want to happen.
No, and I agree with you. And I've been screaming about this for months to whoever will listen. And we've talked about it here. I think that that's exactly where everyone's not going. This whole fractured digital streaming sphere that we're going to, this new model, it's going to cause more and more of this.
How so?
Because, well, okay, so Disney has already decided, right? They wanted Star Wars movies to only be available for streaming on their new streaming service.
Right.
And I believe it's Turner, or it might be Time Warner.
Oh, yeah.
Someone has the exclusive digital rights to these Star Wars movies.
Right.
And refused to sell them back to Disney and said, no, we're keeping them. But Disney wanted them exclusively on their platform. Well, guess what? If you bought a Star Wars movie digitally, what Disney is saying is we are going to shut down all licensing for Star Wars, and you can only watch them in our streaming service.
Well, not if you already...
That's what they're trying to go to.
Not
that's
if you
what
already
they want.
Bought it, though. I mean, you could still watch
it. Well, hey, that's exactly what we're talking about. That's exactly what happened on Apple.
Yeah.
Someone, I want to say they, on iTunes, I thought it was Marvel movies. They had bought some Marvel movies, and the licensing is no longer there, and they got pulled off their account. In Canada.
Okay, yeah, maybe it's like some weird little, because I don't know, who knows? I know that's what we're talking about, so who knows? I'll see if it, I don't know, because I've purchased all the movies digitally, and if when that Star Wars service or when that Disney service starts in 2019, if suddenly I can't watch my Star Wars movies on my thing, I'm going to be pretty miffed about it.
Well, and so will everybody else,
yeah.
But guess what? Star Wars fans have already proven, just like Star Trek fans, they'll buy it anyway. They'll buy it again.
Oh, yes, and well, I say that as someone who owns the original trilogy on VHS, owns them on DVD,
I do
and
too.
Owns them digitally. So yes, I've bought them at least three times, perhaps more. So you're right. But I get back to this idea of things being made easy. An author that I like a lot, Ryan Holiday, he writes a lot of nonfiction that I like very much. And he was interviewed somewhere. And he's someone that I think a lot of has the opinion that a lot of authors have, is that he wishes the publisher would sell his digital books way cheaper. Like he hates that it's even $10 for his book. Like he's like, why not make it a dollar? You'll still make money.
Well, and I'm not in the $10 range, but I don't think an ebook should cost more than $5 or $6. That's where I think they should. I think they should always be less than the paperback. And the publishing stance is that they have to be more than the paperback. And I think that's wrong.
I know this is a thorny issue, and I'm sure listeners, there's some people who are probably going to be on either side of it, and I understand that. What I do with ebooks, anytime I come across a book that I may be interested in as an ebook, whether it's through, I'm on several email newsletters of people who recommend books like every month or every couple of weeks, and I'll read through it and anything that looks interesting, what I do is I put it in my Amazon shopping list. And I check that list every day. And if a book goes on sale, I just automatically buy it. If it's essentially what you said, if it's under $5, I just buy it. Because I'm like, I'll read it at some point.
Sure.
And there are some books on my list that are way more than that. And there's one in particular, and I won't say the name of it because it's someone that we've spoken to before on the show. And I'm sure this particular author has no control over the price of it. So it is not a criticism of this particular author. But it's a book I'm interested in reading. It's on my list. It is $20 for the ebook.
$19.99. Wow.
$19.99. And it's not a particularly long book. And I'm not saying you have to value things. And look, you can make the argument that, well, if you get value out of the book, isn't reading a book worth $20? Sure. And I don't, I'm not saying to devalue the author's time, because we've talked to hundreds of authors over the years. I totally get it. I'm not devaluing, or in my mind, I'm not devaluing what they do. But it seems like you're really diminishing the amount of people that may read that book then by having such a high price tag on it. I don't know. I mean, so you were saying even $5. I mean, I'm willing. I have that list, and sometimes when I'm ready to read my next book, now at this point I've purchased so many books that I don't need to buy another book probably for 10 years. I'll have enough books to read. But sometimes whatever is in my current library may not appeal to me, so I'll look at that list. And if it's something that it really catches my eye and it's 10 bucks or 15 bucks, I'm okay with that. But I'm at that point, I'm highly motivated to buy it. Also, there are certain authors who are my favorites that I just buy the book when it comes out, and I don't care if it's $15 or what have you. There's a couple folks that I'm just like, no, I want that book. I want to read it next. I'm going to buy it. But even for someone like me who reads a lot, there are maybe five authors that I do that with. Maybe. I don't even know if it's that many. So it's rare that I'll just go right out and buy someone's book for that full price. So it seems like reading is not something that everybody does. It's almost like, don't we want to get more people reading, and don't we want to make that path as make as little resistance on that path as possible? I don't know.
Yes, you do, but that's not the sales model.
Yes.
And all of this is being driven by the sales model. Mm-hmm. And the sales model got destroyed by ebooks.
Yeah, I guess so.
And
yeah.
So, and that's why there was the lawsuit. That's why there was the restructuring of how the deals worked specifically with Amazon to give the publishers the rights and the ability to set their own pricing, because their profit center was all rolled up into print media. And the explosion of ebooks was eroding the print side of things. And that's why Borders was having problems and Barnes & Noble and so on and so forth. Like there weren't people buying physical media. And it wasn't just books. I mean, it's also, you know, CDs, DVDs, sure. You name it. Physical media had a lot of problems. And that's where the profit centers were kind of built in. And so now that all of those deals have been restructured and the pricing has been restructured, you do have the ebooks priced higher and they're selling less of them. And now print media is starting to rebound and you're seeing more people buying physical books. And my issue is the same as what you just said. Don't you want more people buying books? And I just feel that if those were priced lower, you would have more people reading, not less people reading.
Yeah. Who knows how the economics of these things work out? I was thinking about this last night because I don't know. Again, you're in that world, so there's a lot of factors to consider when you talk about pricing. So I was thinking about this a lot last night. So I've been going to more and more concerts recently. And last night I went to a concert. This guy, his name is Mike Stern. He's a highly accomplished jazz guitar player. Some might call him a jazz fusion guitar rock kind of guy. Great player. I really like him. And he was playing a show at this place called the Newton Theater, which is about 45 minutes from me. It's out in a more rural area than where I live. And I go to shows there somewhat frequently. His band was four guys, a really great bass player, was one of the reasons I wanted to go, because I'm into jazz bass playing these days. So I wanted to check him out. World-class drummer, this guy named Dennis Chambers, world-class saxophone player, a guy named Bob Franciscini. They were great. I went to the show last night, really loved it. Tickets for the show, my ticket I think was $45, and you know, after the fee I think it was $50. It was not a well-attended show. This theater holds, I'd have to estimate, 500 people, and there were maybe 50 people there. So it was pretty they were great about it. The band was awesome. Like, they were up, because it was a 50 people, but it was a highly engaged, very appreciative fit. Like, people got up standing ovations in the middle of songs because they loved it so much. So it was a highly appreciative crowd, but you know, 50 seats out of 500 seats, it's not a good showing. But I was trying to figure out the economics of it. I'm like, all right, this guy's a big name in terms of jazz. Okay. But jazz is a very small audience compared to, you know, someone who would want to go see Elton John or something, you know? And this is pretty rural. So it's pretty out there. So the audience for this is even smaller as you get out there. And I was thinking, now, does a guy like this, Mike Stern, who's got a big name, who's been around, played with Miles Davis in the 80s, you know, he's a big figure. Does he get a guarantee? Like, for him to come out here, now I'm sure he's New York based, so it's not that bad. But for him to come out here, does he got to get paid $5,000? I don't know. I have no idea. I really don't know the economics of it, because I'm looking around. I'm like, all right, 50 people are here. If everyone had a $40 ticket, I know some of them are more expensive, but let's just use that. So that's $2,000. There are people working in this theater tonight. They got to get paid. The lights got to be put on. Now it's a small theater out in the boonies. So it's, as opposed to the theater in the town that I live in, that's probably union, that probably costs a lot of money just to turn the lights on. It's probably a little better. But I was thinking, does he lose money or does the theater lose money? My guess is the theater is losing money that night. Unless they killed in concessions, because they do sell alcohol there. But I don't think it was that crazy. It was 50 people that maybe had a beer or a glass of wine. I didn't get a drink. So, you know, I don't think everybody did. But it's like, what was the decision? That was kind of a high ticket price for that. But if they lowered the ticket price, would that have brought more people in? Maybe a few, but maybe it makes more sense to charge a higher ticket price because, look, we're probably not going to get more than 50 people anyway. Instead of getting $20 for each person, let's try to get 40. I know these are all, my point is that there's no easy answer to this. I don't know if a lower ticket price would have doubled the amount of people there. My guess is it probably wouldn't have. I don't know if the ticket price scared away that particular audience. I just think the audience in that area is limited. So maybe you're better off charging it a higher ticket price. And I think the comparison can be made to books too, that look, people are going to buy this anyway. And the audience is this size. We'd rather get $15 per person rather than five. I'm sure there's studies on all of this. And that's why there's no one size fits all to this, because you got to do what you think is best. And there are many people making these decisions. But for me, I know I'm price sensitive. I will pull the trigger if it's a certain amount. Like I said, all those books in my shopping list, if it's under $5, I just buy it because I'm just like, I'll read it. Or maybe I won't, but who cares? Like, if I do, that's a bargain and I'll just get it. And I think it's like, yeah. And the way that Amazon works is, look, the more people buy, the more those books start showing up on, you know, if you bought this book, people bought this book, and then you're going to sell even more. So I don't know. I mean, you've probably studied data with this stuff. Like, what do you think? Is it different for everything? Do you think people should kind of go towards a lower price? Like, what do you think?
So You're talking about a free market economy,
yeah,
essentially, John. And it's what the consumer what they'll bear,
yes,
as far as pricing is concerned. And when it comes specifically to ebooks, ebooks exploded. Ebooks were outselling everything else, and there were tons of articles out there saying, "Wow, this is the ebooks are just going crazy. This has to be a fad. It can't be sustained." And then there was the I want to say the warehouse pricing wars between the publishers and Amazon. They sued. They won the rights to individually renegotiate their contracts with Amazon. And their sticking point was, we set our own prices. You don't get to set our prices anymore. And as soon as they got that, they started setting the pricing of ebooks higher than print books. And suddenly, sales of ebooks declined significantly. And then there was all these articles going, well, that there you go. See, that proves the point that ebooks was just a fad. Well, no, it doesn't. It just proves that you raised the fucking price and people can't afford them anymore.
Right.
So now, you know, you can't afford $10 for an ebook, but $5 or $6 for a paperback. Okay, I'll go ahead and buy that.
Yeah, it's true.
You just flipped it. You didn't prove a goddamn thing. I'm a digital marketer. I know exactly the difference between a digital asset and a print asset. I can spend thousands of dollars to do a print asset, or I can spend hundreds of dollars to do a digital asset. And the digital asset is going to outperform the print asset every single time because it's cheap and easy, and the ROI is going to be so much better on that digital asset versus the print asset.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Speaking of that, to bring it back to going to that concert last night, when the show was over, they had CDs for sale. And of course, I've been listening to that new album by Mike Stern on Google Play Music or Spotify or whatever. They were selling the CD, and Mike Stern was there with whoever was his merch person behind the counter selling a CD, and CDs were $20. But the whole thing was Mike Stern was there. You bought it from him. He talked to you for a few minutes. He signed it for you. So you're really paying more for having a minute with the guy that made the record.
Sure.
You know, so I get that, you know, I understand. And it's like, look.
But half the time also, John, that's how that artist makes their money,
yeah,
because they're not getting any money from the music publisher.
Oh yeah. Or very little, at least anyway.
Yeah. So how they make money, it's the whole David Cassidy model, right? He's not getting any money from the Partridge Family. He's the first one that figures out. But if I go on tour, I get the money from the tour. Mm-hmm. I get the money from the swag. So we'll sell t-shirts and we'll sell cassettes and we'll sell albums and we'll sell all this stuff there. I become the reseller. I become the distributor because I'm out doing all these concerts and doing all this stuff and selling all this stuff. Now I'm making money. I'm not making any money off of the traditional media source.
Right.
Which is the TV show.
Right.
It's the same model. And in any concert you go to, you've got the people up on stage, they're playing their music, they're doing stuff, and then they've got the t-shirt sales and the cups and the mugs and the water bottles and the CDs and whatever else they can possibly sell with their name and logo on it, and that's how they're making their bread and butter.
Oh, sure. And nowadays, and I look, hey, I'm all for it.
And authors do the same thing.
Yeah.
I do the same thing. We order wholesale price books from our publisher,
mm-hmm,
right? And we get cases of those to go to an event and sell those books.
Right.
And then we make a little money off of the books that we are selling ourselves. We're becoming the retailer.
Right. And the other big thing that I've noticed, and I think this is fine, I know some people complain about it, is the meet and greet thing. This is with a lot of bands and music artists. So last night, Mike Stern was just there selling a CD. Like there was no VIP package or anything, at least I don't think so. But I went to last summer, I went to go see Toto, who I like a lot, who's kind of having a moment now because like Weezer covered Africa and that's kind of a thing now. Anyway, they're coming around again to my area in November. And I was like, oh yeah, I would like to go see Toto again. I really liked them when I went to go see them a year ago. And it's not sold out yet, but it's pretty close. And the concert's still 2 months away. So they're doing better now. And they did well the last time around. I noticed ticket prices are a little pricier than they were last time. That's fine. I'm cool with that. But, you know, but what I did notice is, you know, the tickets ranged from, I think the cheapest seat is $50, which is probably what I'll go for, because I don't think there's really much else left, up to maybe $100 or maybe like $90 for the, you know, the first section, first row. But then right next to it, there is also the $250 VIP meet and greet. That whole
thing. Right.
And look, you're right, Patrick. That's how they make their money these days. And like, I don't begrudge them at all, because guess what? Especially with these older bands, let's face it, their audience. I know there's younger people coming in too who like it because their parents listen to it or whatever. Great. I'm sure they're happy to have younger people, whatever. But someone in their team realized, hey man, your audience is older. And they love your classic albums, and you're going to go out and play the hits, and you can play whatever else you want. But guess what? These people make some money now. They're not 17-year-olds without a job. They're 45-year-olds. They're 55-year-olds. They got money. Those people who really like you, they want to come backstage. They want to take a picture with you. They want to chit-chat for 2 minutes. Guess what? They're willing to pay $250. Not everybody is going to be able to, but you can really efficiently monetize those people who have a couple extra bucks that want to be back. Because really, if you make a really good salary and you love this band, $250, maybe not a big deal for you. Like, I don't think I'd ever do it, because I always feel that's kind of weird. Like, I just, to me, that just feels like such an artificial situation. Maybe it's because I'm a musician that, I don't know, there's something weird about it. Like, if I met the guys in Toto at a music store farting around on guitars and I got into a conversation with them, I'd be like, yeah, man, I really like dig your records. It's cool. I'd be super happy to that experience. But to pay, and it's not even the money. It's the idea of like this kind of artificial situation where now we're going to try to make small talk. I don't know. It doesn't appeal to me. And it's not about the money. But some people don't care. Like, they love it. They want to get the picture. It used to be autographs. Now it's the picture. I know it used at some point that all people wanted autographs. Now it's, nope, here's my phone. Take a picture. I'm putting it on Facebook. Here we go. Have you ever done any?
I mean, that's the Comic-Con model.
Yeah. That's the what model?
Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Sure. I saw.
You pay your ticket. You pay your ticket to get into the event. Mm-hmm. But if you want to have your picture taken with Nathan Fillion, it's going to cost you this much. If you want your picture taken with Patrick Stewart, it's going to cost you this much. If you want your picture taken with Gail Godot, it's going to cost you this much, so on and so forth. And everything is nickel and diming you.
Why? What the market will bear if people want to pay for it.
And that's exactly right. This is the model that has grown up and evolved, that they have learned people will pay for this. They will pay to have this X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a changing world. I think about it a lot. I listened to Eddie Trunk's podcast the other day, and he had the guitar player from Accept. Accept is a German heavy metal band, most known for the song Balls to the Wall, which came out in like 1981 or whatever. And they're still around, still putting albums out, still doing their thing. And the guitar player had some really interesting thoughts. He's like, yeah, it's different now. You know, back then you'd put an album out and it was a big event and the whole thing. And it's a different world, but I don't know if it was better then, it was different then. There was a lot of problems with the way that things used to be. But for a band like us who had a few hits and had a following, we could still put albums out and they do okay, and we can tour and do great. So we're happy, because I didn't know that I would still be playing heavy metal guitar at age 57 or however old he is. So it's a different world, and I think the, you know, savvy artists and authors and musicians have learned to thrive in that world. And, you know, you can complain about it, and you may be right in your complaints. You may be justified in your complaints, but, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Unfortunately, this is the digital world. You have to deal with it. And I know some people get angry, especially with the music streaming. I have some friends who are musicians who, Spotify is the devil. If you use Spotify or any of those streaming services, you're...
Well, everything is the devil.
Yes.
iTunes was the devil.
Right.
Amazon Kindle is the devil. Now Spotify is the devil.
Right.
And soon it'll be, you know, all the fractured different streaming services. Oh, well, you know, I'm not paying for DC.
Right.
For their streaming service. I'm not going to pay for Disney. I have my Hulu. I have my Netflix. Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
That's just, you know, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's where we're at now. And, it's, you know, I always go back to it this way. If you look at every, especially in music, whatever technological development there was a backlash against it. You know, when radio first started, you know, there was musician unions that were like, oh, radio is killing music because people can just listen to it in their house. And now they're not coming to concerts and we have to ban radio. You know, it's an old story. It's just, things need to be, you know, whether you like it or not, like, that's where we're at. Like, and I'm sorry. And maybe I don't feel that sorry though. Like, look, I pay my $10 a month. I listen to what I want. I like it. It's legal. You know, the artists that really do poorly, I think, are the ones that have these big record deals where the record company is making most of the money from streaming. So what gets carried over to the artist is very small and it is unfair. But I think artists that have better deals or don't have a record deal at all and it's just independent, they do much better. But who knows? I don't know. This is a thorny topic, I know. But that's where I stand on it. Anyway. All right, Patrick. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we wrap it up here today?
No, this does get my hackles up. Because, again, I'm a digital marketer. And you know, I started out doing print marketing many, many years ago, and I have transitioned in the last decade to digital stuff, and that's primarily my job, is all digital.
Right.
And when someone sits down with me and says that digital costs way more than print, I just laugh in their face.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Because it's ridiculous, you know. We do digital stuff every day. We save tens of thousands of dollars in our marketing department by not doing print. We barely do anything print anymore. We have huge flat screen TVs in all of our retail locations, and we feed digital content to those screens.
Mm-hmm.
And that saves us so much money because we don't have to sit there and print stuff out and deal with, you know, is it going to be a web press? Is it going to be a digital press? Is it going to be this? Is it going to be that? What are the colors going to look like? Oh, send us proofs. Go back and forth and back and forth. We don't have to do any of that anymore. We just do it all digitally. We push the content. We can change it on the fly. We can change it whenever we need to change it. All of our ads online, you know, we can do the same thing there. Trust me, I know how these things work.
Mm-hmm.
And it frustrates the hell out of me when someone sits across the table. I mean, we got into it with Lou Andrews years ago.
Yeah.
Because Lou's like, well, you don't understand that, you know, the ebook actually costs more to produce than the print book. Bullshit.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, and here's a final thought on it, is that I have 3 albums out digitally, 2 under the name John Anelio, 1 under my real name, John Mazzarella. And I haven't put new music out in 5 years. I don't know, maybe more than that now. I don't talk about it anymore. I don't promote it anymore. It exists out there though. Like, if you put either of those names in a search engine, I will have those albums will come up on Spotify, whatever. It's on every digital service. I don't do anything with them anymore. I still, and everybody, I hate to break the cold reality of it to you. I get about $10 in my PayPal account every couple of months from CD Baby, which is the company that I use to put it out, which it's hilarious. But at the same time, I haven't made new music in 5 years. I'm doing nothing to promote that music at all, but it exists out there. it's technically an income stream. It's a very little income stream, but every, like, I don't know, 3-4 months, I get an email. It's like, hey, you just got $10.03 from CD Baby for selling your music. And they'll tell me what songs were streamed or what have you. And it's nice. And if I was out there making new music, I'd probably get more of that. But the point is, do you think I've sold a physical CD in 5 years? Hell no. I haven't done any of that. You know, I didn't even make physical copies of my last album because it cost too much, or it wasn't worth it in my mind, because to make even 100 copies would have cost like $300 or $400. And that's just for the physical. That's not talking about art design and all that. And I was just like, why am I going to get these? No one buys CDs anymore. It's going to be 100 coasters in my house. So forget it. But digital exists and it can keep making money for you. So I think that's a thing that people don't think about all the time when they have these digital arguments either, is that that my digital catalog, as meager as it is, still earns me some money. My physical catalog doesn't do anything because I don't even have it anymore. So I don't know. Thorny topic, Patrick. Thorny topic. Anyway, what's how's everything going? You mentioned, I don't know if when this is going to air, if you had a in-person event coming up. I don't know if that'll be passed by the time this airs or not.
I'll also be at Mile High Con in October, which I believe is the 19th, 20th, and 21st.
Cool. I'm glad to hear you doing some good stuff there.
Well, and it's the 50th. For Mile High Con, so it's a huge milestone. They're having guests of honor from past cons, going back as far as they possibly could, getting all kinds of people to come. So it should be a really nice big convention this year with tons of great people.
Awesome. I know I've mentioned it before, and I want to actually get a little more serious about it. When I mean seriously, I think it would be really fun. We gotta find a con that works for both of us to go to again. Because I just feel like, you know, what we've talked about a lot recently, how I just, at this point, I view myself as the person that does this podcast, and it's cool. Having no agenda, as you put it, going into it, just being like, I like these people and I like reading these books and I like talking to Patrick, and I would love to go to one and kind of do what we did at Capricorn 4 years ago or whatever it was, and do something, you know.
Oh, boy. Now you're going to get Joe sending us messages saying, well, it was actually X number of years ago.
Right. I think the last time I said it was 2, and then he said, it's coming up on 4, dude. And I'm like, oh, okay. obviously, if you are on the chair of your con and would like to have Patrick and I as special guests, we would love to talk to you. But even if we, you know, just found one that kind of made sense and for us to go out to, I would love that again. I think that would be great because I do miss it. It's been that Capricorn, I think, is the last one that I went to. And as we said, 4 years ago now. So I'm way overdue.
Well, what needs to happen is the listeners need to nominate us for a Hugo, and then we can just go to Dublin.
Well, that works too. All right, you're hearing everybody? This is in your hands. It's in your hands. Nominate us for a Hugo. Although now that's over, that voting, right? That's all done now, right?
Well, for this year, but for next year, it would be Dublin.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. I'll go to Dublin.
Yeah.
I'll get a passport and I'll go. All right.
There you go.
All right, everybody. Well, hope you enjoyed this episode too. If you dig what we're doing here, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything else before we go?
Nope, that's it.
All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.